Hello everyone, welcome to our first binary episode of the new year. I'm Spectre with me as Z. Just a reminder that the podcast is VOD only now, that we're not doing live streams of the podcast anymore for the time being. Z may do some prep streams, but otherwise podcast stuff will be on Spotify, YouTube, and our usual platforms going forward. Just wanted to give that a quick mention.
Yeah, but I'll make an attempt this weekend, so like the upcoming weekend after this gets published too. Maybe try doing a prep stream or two, just where I'm gathering the topics, going through, getting notes on them, and there'll be a chance for people who do want to come in chat and talk about the topics and stuff. That'll be a chance to kind of get in there, ask questions, or even suggest topics or whatever. Like, see part of that flow and have a bit more of a casual thing going on there, rather than the podcast itself being streamed.
Let's just keep some of the interaction without trying to do both on the same stream. Because part of the thing, too, before was that with the stream, we didn't want to go tangentially off too much onto chat discussion to keep the audio clean for the typical platforms that we put the podcast out on. But so that kept us from being casual, but also like people who are listening don't get all the context of the chat. So it's just kind of weird. This way, it allows us to separate it a lot better. So,
and flexibility on when we actually decide to record these, which, you know, can be nice.
Very nice. But yeah, with that said, it's good to be back. I am feeling better since the last binary episode we did, that's for sure. If you want to hear a little bit about what Z and I were up to over the winter break, we discussed that at the top of the bounty episode for this week. Unfortunately, we didn't get to go to CCC this year, as CCC happened really late, and I haven't been able to catch up yet on all the really good talks that were presented at CCC. This was a really good year for talks. Though we do have one in this episode. Other than that, though, next week we'll try to give some recommendations of talks we found interesting and such after we get into them more, but we're not going to talk about it so much this week because we just haven't had a chance to check a lot of it out yet. So,
yeah, basically we will go into just that. Like this episode, we've got one topic from CCC, and last episode we had one topic from CCC, so we've got two of them, but yeah, I think there were a lot more talks that I want to check out before I actually recommend any for people to take a look at.
So with that said, we can start to get into topics. Up first, we just wanted to we'll start off with shoutouts. We'll kind of break the paradigm today. So starting out, we did want to mention that Paged Out has put out a new issue number 3, and this is quite significant because Z told me before we ran the podcast that this is the first issue that they've had. Like the last time they put out an issue, we talked about it on episode, what was it, 19, I think, of the podcast.
Episode 19. We started off the episode talking about their release of issue 2.
Yeah, so 4 years, basically. We're on episode 234 now, so it's been a while.
Yeah, we've made it through quite a few episodes since then. I'll be honest, a little bit disappointed by this issue. I think in part it's just because they collected a lot of these things over the last 4 years before they finally put out an issue. So some of these posts were written, you know, in 2020. Some, I'm sure, probably 2019, but for sure from 2020 and stuff. So there is some kind of aging aspects even to these posts, unfortunately. I haven't made it through all of them to actually try calling anything out, but yeah.
What I like to do with the issues is just open up the table of contents and then just find out like issues that I think have an interesting title. You know, maybe there are some people who like to go through like every article that's in there. One of the things with Paged Out is that I believe every article is confined to one page. Yeah. So you do kind of get that nice succinct article, whereas, you know, sometimes like, and they talk about some complex topics too. Like it is an art form to condense technical information so precisely like that, so it's cool for that aspect. But yeah, Paged Out is a pretty cool technical magazine that was started a little while ago, and like we said, it's been a while since there's been an issue, so wanted to shout it out on the episode.
Yeah, like yeah. I like the idea of, like I said, as all of these just one pager articles on some sort of hacker-ish topic. I mean, it's not specifically security or hacking, so I've got the table of contents up here, and they've got art, AI, crypto, hardware, programming. Like, there's a lot of things. And just kind of at the end here, we've got some security and hacking aspects. So it's just a lot of more tech content all on one page, which is still pretty cool. And it's a really good variety of stuff. So, like, there's usually at least something should catch your eye.
All right, so getting into some vulnerabilities. Up first, we have a post from Talos on an integer underflow in GPSD or the GPS daemon, specifically in the parsing of NTRIP or network transport of RTCM via IP packets. And GPSD is used a lot in Android and embedded systems. They call it like military systems, self-driving vehicles, things like that. And what's important here is that GPSD can get GPS info from the network through NTRIP, where it'll send an HTTP request to the caster, get a source table as a response, which has a table of records, which is eventually used to get specific GPS data. In parsing the HTTP response, they do line-based parsing, where it'll continuously parse lines until it encounters a carriage return or a null byte. And this get line function will, they do some buffer tracking, so it will decrement the in buff len on each character of the buffer as it goes through it. The problem is, though, that this get line function will just continuously be called until it finds a carriage return or a null byte. And that buff len subtraction will continue to happen pretty much unconditionally. The loop will break if the in buff len reaches zero. However, when it gets called again, that in buff len will go negative, underflow to a large value. Then later on, if that in buff len is non-zero, the code tries to copy whatever's left using memmove. Of course, it uses that in buff len of a large value, which triggers a buffer overflow. So fairly straightforward vulnerability in how it works. It's one of the pitfalls you have to deal with when you're dealing with line-based parsing and keeping track of the buffer, and sort of like a logical issue that can lead to memory corruption. I mean, you can say that in a lot of cases, but in this case, it's just that get line being able to continuously be called and the attacker just refusing to provide a null byte or carriage return for processing that data. So, as
Yeah,
usual with
and
Talos, I don't really go into exploitation of this, but especially in like embedded applications, it's probably pretty exploitable.
yeah, like one of the things I'd kind of call out on this is I feel like Lexer get line should have had either some way to flag, hey, I'm out of data, like I ran through all of the data so it doesn't end up getting called again, or having some check inside of it to make sure. Like instead of just assuming and going through the standard process on every loop, actually doing more of a check there on the values that it currently has for Lexer. There are a number of ways this I think could, or a number of good practices that could have stopped this sort of bug. Because yeah, I do think like the key thing is the fact that Lexer could be called when it's about to go out of bounds. Like that feels like a scenario it should be able to catch. Even if like at on this last point there, when it has nothing left to read, setting a single flag saying it's read everything, like kind of a common practice just missing here, but it is a fun bug I think to see it kind of decrement. I mean it's an underflow, but in a sense it's trying to decrement itself out of bounds too. Technically it's not, but I don't know, I thought it was kind of fun on that aspect.
Yeah, and the code that's posted here, you can see immediately, like, oh, this looks like there's probably going to be problems here. Getting into a more complicated vulnerability, we also have a post on exploiting a libwebp bug that we had talked about previously when it comes to parsing Huffman code tables. So Z covered this one last time and has dealt a bit more with Huffman, and I'll let him get into this one.
Yeah, so I, like you mentioned, I did cover this before. That was back on episode 218. That was just in October, beginning of October. So, right when we came, right around when we were coming back with the podcast, I think. Covered it there to kind of have a summary of the bug itself. And we kind of ended off that discussion because we ended up spending a good chunk of time on that one. And we kind of ended off on this being a rather, or seeming to be a rather complex bug that would be difficult to write like a new exploit for. And so lo and behold, I actually came across this post, which is from November, so we are covering it pretty late, at least compared to our usual speed of getting on these things. But in November, where they do take, it's a two-part blog post where they do actually take this from that bug, from that Huffman coding bug, and turn this into a Chrome exploit. So they were able to do so, and were able to do so relatively quickly, quicker than I think I might have expected. I don't know how long they actually spent on it. They don't talk about like their actual time there, but what they were able to get, so the initial information about this Huffman coding issue was basically that in parsing like the WebP files, it would be generating this Huffman table. It would generate, or it would actually generate multiple Huffman tables. So Huffman tables are just like another form of Huffman trees, which are commonly used for encoding where you have like the bit prefix and values being associated with that. I go into some of the complexities of the actual Huffman format, but what was going on here is basically it's parsing, or it's creating a single block of memory for five Huffman tables. Five tables are of different sizes, and that's just covering your different channels, like your red, blue, green, alpha, and then lastly, the distance channel. And it's creating a different tree, so basically all of them get their own encoding tables so they can be decoded, or basically be compressed more effectively by doing it just on a channel-by-channel basis, creating these five tables. And the vulnerability was that it would pre-compute the maximum size for these tables. And the issue there is it kind of assumed that these were well-behaved or well-formatted tables. Actually, since I'm bringing this up, the original post that we covered the bug with had a really great kind of illustration of what the tables... Normally, the table would look something like this, where you've got... Of course, it's highlighted here. There we go. Where you've got, like, your bit prefix along the left-hand side of the... Well, left-hand side as kind of you're looking at this image. And then you've got the values associated with that as it goes through. And there's a bit of a formatting to it, but you have this kind of balance to it. Then if you compare that with one of the buggy trees... You just have a lot more entries in here. You have a lot more nodes, and a lot of these nodes are not actually valid inside the Huffman encoding because they would be ambiguous. They couldn't actually be decoded properly. I won't get into how that works, but point being, you could end up creating a tree that ends up being much larger than it expects, and so it could potentially overflow. The challenge is that it's creating space for five different trees. And so... if any of these trees are actually incorrect, when it finishes parsing the tree, it goes and looks at the tree and it's like, hey, this is way bigger. This isn't the right size. You know, let's just terminate everything and stop running because I don't like this. This is not right. So you can't just do this on all of the trees in order to overflow. And you are limited in terms of the size of the table it will even try to decompress. And so we come back to today's post, where effectively what they found, they, you know, looked into this more, and they were able to create kind of a core primitive. You have the Huffman table being created, and this Huffman table is containing all of the Huffman tables, despite the name kind of being singular. You have your first four tables, and those are just going to be created as max size. They're not going to be corrupted. That way the last table has the best chance of being able to overflow and actually get into, like, the next chunk of memory. And they do talk a little bit about how now they're crafting the table. If you want those details, you can read the post. I did have a bit of a rough time following some of it. Probably it would just help to have more, a better understanding of the Huffman coding itself too. Nonetheless, what they were able to do was on that last bit, so on your kind of largest bit prefixes, the 15-bit code lengths, that's going to be the table that ends up overflowing. One other detail, I guess, I just showed the WebP tree. This tree, while this is a visualization of the Huffman coding and it's generally visualized as a tree, what's actually going on in the code being used is a bit more of an efficient representation where it uses a table, uses a block of memory, and it's calculating the indexes in there based off of the bit prefix. So it's not exact, it's not actually being stored as a tree, it is being stored just as a singular table. I kind of glossed over that earlier, but they go into how the index is calculated. So when it does go out of bounds, it's not a linear write exactly. It's going to be writing based off of what that prefix is. And they talk here like they kind of have the code here for get next key, which is use, figure out this, being like the bitwise reversal of the bits in the key. I'm going to be honest, I'd have to sit down probably... play with the code a little bit in context to get exactly how it's doing this. But what they determined is that they could use the 9-bit code length and they could use multiple entries in there to basically push it. So when this 15-bit code, the kind of longer one or slightly larger one, they would basically be able to use that for every 9-bit code that they would have in the table. it would push where the 15-bit code would write out of bounds by about 2 bytes, or not 2 bytes. It would push the index by 2. So that would be your full, because of writing 4 bytes of data, so that would be your full like 8 bytes. And so basically they could get their out of bounds right to land at a semi-relative or semi-controlled position where it would be based off of how many of those 9-bit code links they actually had in there, how far down in the overflow it ended up going. They would have the control to kind of have that aligned on 8 bytes. So every 8 bytes they could end up writing 4 bytes. And the other challenge with this, and part of why I wasn't too sure what the exploit process would look like for it, is that the value that you're writing isn't controllable. Long story short, the memory layout of the data that's actually being written is this uint8 of bits, which is the number of bits. So we're talking about the code size being like 9 or 15 or whatever, along with the actual, actually that might be bits for the value, sorry. Either way, you have kind of a somewhat controllable value there of the bits, and then it's actually writing a 16-bit value in there as part of this Huffman code structure, which is going to be more attacker controllable. However, it is still kind of with a range limit of, in this case, only 0 to 39. So this value part of the structure could be 0 to 39. And the number of bits is a bit more restricted, as like between 1 and 15 being the number of bits in that prefix code. So that's going to be limited by what stage it's in for where it's writing. So basically, the only overflow one I believe is going to be with the 15. And then this is going to be padded when 1 byte of padding kind of in the middle there, as for the actual structure. So it's writing 4 bytes. It's not arbitrarily controlled, but you do have it at kind of relative offset, and it's an 8 byte, or yeah, 8 byte kind of relative offset there is kind of friendly to exploitation. It would be more ideal if you could say, like, I want to write this exactly here, but 8 bytes isn't a weird offset. It's not like if you had,
It's aligned at least.
yeah, that's, that line was the word kind of escaped me there. But yeah, the fact that it's a line means like you could probably line this up with data that you'd like and it could be useful. Whereas you're like 15 bytes, it could be aligned, but you could also be very off because of it. Just as an example of other kind of offsets. So yeah, basically not a good amount of control over the data, but the alignment definitely helps you. And so then there is part two of this post, which gets into the actual exploitation of the issue and turning this into a Chrome exploit. Starts off with a bit of a summary over what we've just said. They summarize the primitive as, we can write a partially controlled 4-byte integer with an offset that is a multiple of 8 bytes. And they're going out of bounds. Talks a little bit about how they try to find another object or an object that they would be able to overwrite, where they had a little bit of an interesting challenge with that. So the Huffman table itself is in a hex 3000 byte bucket. So they mentioned that objects between hex 2800 and 3000, or hex 3000 bytes, all kind of can get stored inside of this bucket area. Unfortunately, they don't find a lot of other objects that are that size. In fact, they call out, they had a CodeQL query from one of Manny Mo's posts, who works over at a GitHub Security Lab, and we've covered posts from him before. Had a CodeQL query, and the query result was empty. So no other objects that they could overflow into. Of course, you do have the dynamically sized objects, objects that don't have a fixed size, or variable length objects, which can still end up being allocated in that same bucket, which is what they talked about as at least one option here, with the audio array as being an option for it. Although they don't go for that, they end up actually looking for just all of the fast alloc calls, looking at those calls, and they eventually find CSS variable data as a class that gets allocated and has an attacker controlled size. And this just represents the actual, like, in CSS, you can create a variable and give it an arbitrary value. And you can also mess with that in JavaScript, making it a little bit nicer to work with programmatically rather than inside of the actual CSS style tags. But yes, yeah, so they decide to target, this CSS variable data as what they want to overflow into. I guess I will also mention that with this overflow, because of the fact they don't have arbitrary control over the data, you do have limits on what you can corrupt. A natural target, I think, anytime that you're able to write like an integer, in cases where you're just writing a 1 or a 2 or something, it's nice. But reference counts are kind of a good target to consider corrupting. You wouldn't be able to really target a pointer with this. So a common technique would be, use your corruption to corrupt a pointer to create like an arbitrary read-write primitive. You wouldn't really be able to do that with this because you don't have that level of control over the data that you're writing. But a length field would be another option. You can potentially target some length field and get just as a wrong value, hopefully a higher value. So it's actually, writing something or able to then be used to read something large out of bounds. But those would be like the two big things. And they actually do kind of use both here. But with the CSS variable data specifically, they target that. So they groom that into place. Little bit of grooming information. But the gist is creating a window and getting the... basically, they allocate a bunch of these CSS variables and then free some of them. They had to free, I want to say, like 8 of them for reasons of the allocator doing some local caching and preferring the cache so it wouldn't send it over. But after all of that, they end up getting their CSS variable and then getting some windows in there containing the Huffman codes and part of the tables. They get that inside of that window so that they could then overflow into, like, from the Huffman code into a CSS variable. That's what they want. And then at the start of the CSS variable, it does in fact have a reference count and a length and some flags. And actually, good point. Flags are another thing when you have, I would look for flags more when it comes to having very small writes, but they could be another good corruption target just because oftentimes in that you're dealing with a single bit flip can completely change certain key areas of functionality. So you can use that often to like introduce type confusions or something like that. So in this case, I don't think we get much information over what the flags were used because the way the CSS variable data is used is, at least as we see it here, just storing a string. Perhaps a flag would also have like an int or something if you weren't using a string type CSS variable, but I'm not sure about that. Either way, they have basically all of the options with the CSS variable. And what they end up going for with it is they do just target the reference count. Reference count is a nice target because that can lead you into a use after free situation when you have a corrupted ref count. Although when you corrupt a ref count, you often want to put that value to be lower than what the original value was. So if the actual reference count at the time is like 5, you want to put it down to 2. And then as things release their references, one, you'll have like some that release their reference, the count goes down to 0, but there are still references lasting or that exist to it, giving you that use after free, because when it hits 0, it's going to free it, but you still have things holding on to a reference. So with this one, where you don't, like, you can't necessarily write a 0 to this, you can't just, or just the 1 to it, you control only part of the value. That does mean this reference count, you do need to do a little bit more work to get that reference count up higher than whatever your overwrite value would be. And for that, they just use multiple calls to get property value, which would increment the reference count until the garbage collection ran. Do a bunch of calls with that, get reference count bumped high enough, use the corruption to write to something a little bit lower. They talk about targeting this as getting a... So it starts off with the initial reference count at 2, and then they would call get property value K overwrite ref time, so that is just whatever their overwrite value would be. They call it that many times so that the reference count gets increased to whatever value they're going to corrupt it with plus 2. So they kind of have 2, or when they corrupt it, it is 2 values too low and you get the use after free. And specifically 2, you'll end up having 2 dangling references to it when it ultimately comes down. So as far as that goes, like all of this has largely been, I think applicable to other sources outside of just Chrome. Like, yeah, you're not going to have CSS variable data, but you could have reference counts and other things. This sort of corruption strategy is pretty fair to go with other things or with other targets. I think you'd be able to apply that. The rest of this post go ahead.
I believe back when we talked about this bug initially, we had speculated that this would probably be how you would take advantage of it, would be trying to hit an adjacent object's reference count or something like that. That is a good shout with the flags, though. Like, being able to get more of a logic-type bug, where it could be more reliable to exploit. But, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Hitting the reference count is definitely, like, where my mind first goes.
I mean, reference count is just such a sweet target to have. Like, it should be where your mind goes almost all the time. But yeah, the flags are just with really minor changes. You can sometimes get a lot, so it's good to at least remember it. And I did take me seeing flags to remember I even wanted to bring that up. The rest of this post does get a little bit more Chrome specific. They end up using this use after free they introduced. They could use that to get an out-of-bounds read or an overread, basically, with the audio array object. So once they had kind of the use after free, the entire data off audio array is attacker controlled. So the original CSS variable, they could then corrupt its length value to something really high. And then when they try to read the variable's value, the length is going to be much higher than what it should be, and it'll read out of bounds. So they could get a read. They could potentially leak something, but they still need other objects to be nearby or to do that. So they actually end up going into this whole cross-bucket allocation, trying to get a allocation that... Actually, I guess the route that they went here is they started targeting the actual heap meta information or metadata, end up going for a double free route, corrupting the free list. And in a similar way, they call it out here, it gives you a similar endpoint as like a FASTBin attack, where because it's storing some of this free list, storing a free list entry kind of in line, they use the corruption to corrupt that, get an arbitrary address reallocated later. There are some restrictions on what that address could be. Couldn't just be anything. So the double free, there's no double free checks when they're actually being freed, but when they get reallocated, it has this is sane check to make sure it's like a sane free pointer that's being used there. It just has to be the same super page, and it can't point to the metadata area. So there's general heap metadata that you can point that to, versus this free list is stored in line, but everything else is stored elsewhere. But that is getting a little bit more onto the internals of the Chrome allocator, so I don't want to dive into it here, but there is a little bit more to this exploit to actually take it to RC that I'd say, you know, check out the post if you want that. They do also call out that it's still an open question on how to exploit this under, you know, something like PAC existing. This is just kind of taking it from Crash and kind of the questions over how exploitable it is there. Of course, this wasn't in the wild bug, so it was known that this would be exploitable. But yeah, this basically takes it and, you know, creates a pretty usable primitive from it. That was the thing that caught my eye initially, was what type of primitive were you really going to have with this? So it was kind of a useful primitive to see, a little bit of restrictions on it, nothing too bad ultimately, but does kind of take that deeper understanding of the Huffman coding and, you know, a lot of front-loaded knowledge in order to actually get to reproducing the bug.
This chain's a great example of chaining together corruption primitives, but you're escalating from your initial limited out-of-bounds write to get a better out-of-bounds write to create a UAF and... I might have got that backwards, but
yeah, it's
really, you can kind of see what I mean. It's just escalating your primitives, and it's a really good example of that.
Yeah, and because they have kind of a couple options with that too, because they go from when they get that use that free, it's like, well, how do you use that? They could go for the overread, which I talked about, but they also go from that point into the double free scenario, and they do utilize both that. They do utilize the overread along with some other stuff here in order to think get some pointer. I think that's kind of what they're going for. Part of the exploit, they seem to also drop off on details a little bit because they take inspiration just from one of Manny Moe's pages or blog posts, sorry, and just kind of say that and don't go into all the details for how they did it. I assume that's in Manny Moe's post, though. It's a really nice chain. I appreciate the write-up, and I appreciate seeing somebody actually try and take this one to an exploit, because I personally did not want to spend the time getting familiar enough with Huffman coding, but it did seem like an interesting bug to check out. So it's nice to see somebody pushed it ahead.
Yeah. And speaking on mitigations like pack and MTE, we have a post specifically on MTE from Dark Navy as well. Yeah. So this post talks a little bit about MTE specifically when it comes to heap allocators. So we've talked about MTE a fair amount on the podcast, like a lot. Just as a bit of a refresher, though, memory tagging basically takes advantage of the top biting NOR feature of ARMv8, which allows the top unused 4 bits of a pointer to contain a tag, which on memory accesses of that pointer. There's instrumentation and special instructions that can be used to check the tag against the shadow mapping, which maps which memory areas should correspond to which tag. And if there's a tag mismatch, the CPU will throw an exception. There is some nuances there I'm skipping over, like sync mode versus async mode, but that's not super relevant for this post. So to do this, some instructions were added to the ARMv8 ISA to do the tagging, but it's up to the compiler and the application or library to actually use those instructions to leverage memory tagging, and how they do that is done fairly differently. Especially where this is relevant is at the heap allocator level, because most people aren't going to be looking, like, they're not even going to think about memory tagging, so they're not going to write code to do it specifically. They're going to rely on the heap allocator doing that for them. So they talk about three common allocators, starting off with the Chrome or partition alloc. They talk about three potential flows you can end up in for allocations. You can either end up allocating from the thread cache, which doesn't change the tag. You can allocate from a free slot span, which again returns without changing the tag, or allocate a new slot span, which will get tagged randomly. And upon freeing of a slot, the tag is just simply incremented, which isn't great as it's pretty deterministic. So here they speculate on an attack that could be leveraged to bypass MTE in like a UAF scenario, being you could trigger a vulnerability to obtain a UAF victim, but don't trigger the UAF at that point, like the use part of it. Allocate and free the object of the victim size 15 times to basically recycle the tag to what it was before. Because you only have 4 bits to work with, that's pretty feasible to overflow. And then trigger the UAF. This way, both objects have the same tag, MTE isn't triggered, and you're good to go. Ultimately, they were somewhat disappointed in the MTE implementation for partition alloc, but where you're in the browser and whatnot, they prioritized efficiency over extensive tagging, and that's just a trade-off that was made there. The next allocator they talk about is glibc's ptmalloc, which is probably the most familiar one to people. In this case, all allocations are tagged with a random non-zero tag, and chunk headers for metadata was tagged with a fixed zero value upon release. So it's very straightforward. Everything is tagged. The tag space is reduced by a little bit by using zero as like a special tag, so you only have like 15 instead of 16 potential tags or whatever. It's also interesting how they use zero for freed chunks, and they state that while this might seem insecure at first, it actually ends up being pretty effective, because in the case of use after freeze, it guarantees that a freed chunk won't have the same tag as an allocated one. And also, there's a free chunk placed between every two chunks, which makes it act effectively as a guard page that can mitigate linear overflows. So ptmalloc, while being like the more common allocator and simpler one, is doing a pretty good job when it comes to MT implementation. The final one that they looked at was Android Scudo allocator, which they admit is the most complex one. And there's two flows they talk about here. You can have both primary chunks and secondary chunks. Primary chunks just being really large sized allocations that are over hex 10,000. And secondary chunks are allocated through memory mapping. Primary chunks are tagged while secondary chunks aren't. So when a freed primary chunk gets reused...
I just want to jump really quickly. I think maybe I misheard you, but I think you might have mentioned that primary ones were greater than hex 10,000 bytes, but primary types are than 10,000. Secondary type is a large one.
Yeah,
I did. Minor detail, but.
Yeah. So, yeah, primary chunks are tagged while the secondary ones aren't. When a freed primary chunk gets reused, it basically just reuses the same tag that was assigned at release time. Otherwise, it allocates a random tag. There's also a configuration option called use odd even tags, which keeps in mind the parity of the tag to ensure that adjacent chunks have a different parity, which is pretty interesting. As they say, it offers a trade-off, basically. So you reduce the tag space a bit since you're having it essentially by having odd and even. So that like makes UAF easier to exploit. But because adjacent chunks will always have a different parity and thus will never have the same tag, it does a better job at detecting buffer overflows. So just kind of trading off UAF ease of exploitability for buffer overflow ease of exploitability, which in certain cases may make sense.
Honestly, seems like a pretty fair trade-off. Because in a lot of cases, while, yeah, the technically UAF detection is a bit weaker Like, in most scenarios, it's not that different, but you gain the linear detection, which is a very common situation to end up in. I mean, granted, you zap free is too, but I don't know.
But I
Personally,
think
I like
buffer
the
overflows still
trade-off.
do have an edge in most areas. I'm just thinking of the Google post they did like every so often where they talk about the vulnerability landscape and the percentage of reports that are
Yeah,
broken
actually,
down into UAF and buffer overflow and such.
right at the top of this post, it is with 2019, but I actually thought the little graph here was a little bit interesting too. Or they talk about the different like stack corruptions you see kind of disappearing down at the bottom and kind of the commonality, or this is the root cause of CVEs by patch year up to the year of 20. Looks like I guess the last one's 2018, but that's because this is a presentation in 2019. Although this has use after free is this dark. I think that's this dark blue at the top.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, versus the more generic heap corruption, which I assume is going to be your linear heap overwrite. So, I mean, that's kind of putting it as the linear one is less common.
Heap
But
corruption is a little bit vague,
it is. You'd have to look at
but.
it. Because they also have heap out of bounds read being like the green one on. Kind of that green one second from the top. So yeah, I think I'd have to dig into exactly how that works. Yeah, that is a bit vague. Either
Yep.
way, personally, I'm just saying I kind of like that choice and that configuration. Like, I think it makes sense to do.
But that's pretty much all this blog post goes into with how the implementation works. It functions, I think, as a nice cheat sheet and summary of how MT is implemented across some of the common allocators. And as always, it's a good demonstration of the kind of trade-offs vendors want to make when it comes to performance versus security. You can kind of see where their head is at when it comes to mitigating against different types of vulnerabilities, as well as just mitigating versus efficiency. So I kind of like that the post goes into that part of it and rationalizes some of the choices that were made. And like I said, it's just good information to have if you're looking to target as MTE becomes more prevalent. It's not super prevalent yet, but I'm sure it will become more so over the next decade or whatever.
Yeah, it's a good post. We're basically covering almost the entirety of, or we are covering the entirety of this person's blog today. So I'm looking forward to what else they end up putting out.
Yeah, the posts are really re well written and stuff, and they're interesting articles. So hopefully there's some more cool stuff that comes out of them soon. Right, so getting into the CCC presentation that we teased at CCC, an insane iPhone attack chain was published, titled Operation Triangulation. This was by Kaspersky researchers, and it's titled What You Get When You Attack iPhones of Researchers, because they ended up capturing the exploit chain and all the stages and everything off of researchers who had been targeted. They start off the presentation talking about the mistakes that the attackers had made, which was kind of funny. Basically, it came down to the fact that they didn't disguise network activity very well. There was always these like four domains that were kind of a similar schema where it was like two words, .com, like backuprabbit.com or cloudsponsor.com. And there was always iMessage activities right around the traffic to those said domains. They also didn't remove all artifacts. Like, for example, they tried to remove attachments with exploits and stuff from iMessage, but they didn't delete the attachment folders. They discovered this backup agent application, which was sending network traffic. And while it was a legitimate application name, it's been deprecated for some time, so it shouldn't be sending traffic. So they noticed these things and they decided to set a trap where they basically set up a man in the middle. They installed their own root SSL certificates, routed traffic through a MITM proxy that would capture everything. And they were able to get all the stages. The stages were decrypted, or sorry, encrypted, but they were able to decrypt them and whatnot. So ultimately, there were four vulnerabilities that comprised this chain. Where it started out was a TTF or TrueType font exploit in PDF that was implemented in TrueType VMASM. They targeted this adjust instruction, which the researchers who presented that at CCC noted was an undocumented instruction. Not only was it undocumented, it seemed to be like completely unused. The only mention they could find of it was from a very old Windows build from like the 90s, and it just didn't do anything because it was only used by Apple. So, of
Yeah,
course,
I kind
this
of love
undocumented
that.
function was the source of a bug.
I kind of love that detail there. Just the fact that, yeah, they apparently had like a source dump from the 90s of some Windows code where just, I'm trying to pull it up in the actual video here. where it literally just has this comment, Apple only instructions and the two opcodes for the adjust command. Because technically, I guess it is two different. There's two kind of implementations, one for each of them that work opposite, but I'll let you get into that.
Yeah, so this adjust instruction, it's not totally clear what it does. I'm not super well versed in TrueType font or anything, but the comment there states that the function was used for adjusting points from start to end. So it'll take a current
or
point.
Or from end to start.
Yeah, either way. So it'll take a current point, set the value in it in this points and flags array, and then increment it unless it's gone to the end point, in which case it resets it back to the start point. Or in the other direction, it'll decrement it unless it's the start point, where it'll reset it back to the end point. The problem is, in that second case, there's an off by one, because the end point should be at end minus one, but they just take the end point. It seems to be sort of a copy-paste bug, where they just copy this, the going from one direction into the other direction and replace start point with end point, not taking into account that end point was beyond the bounds of the buffer. So that allows out-of-bounds access, which they state is fairly easy to exploit. I think they say, like, this bug from the 90s is exploited like it, bugs from the 90s were. So kind of a funny quip there. And yeah, like, this adjust functionality has been around for a very long time, since the early 90s. But there is a bit of an interesting history there, because it was silently removed from iOS 16.3 and macOS 13.2 in January of 2023. But by that point, they say it was already being exploited. And this bug was only fixed in iOS 15 and macOS 12 after the report in July. So their speculation was that Apple was receiving crash reports from, like, crash artifacts from trying to exploit this bug. But they weren't totally sure what the bug was at the time, and they were like, this is unused functionality, let's just strip this out. But because it wasn't recognized as a security fix, it wasn't backported to the other, like, iOS versions. So that effectively gives them, I believe, an arbitrary write in process memory. It's not totally clear. They skip over the exploitation of this bug in the presentation, but given the context, that's, I believe, what they ultimately get. Issue number two is where they can escalate further by bypassing PAC, or pointer authentication codes, and it's essentially a technique that gives them a signing primitive to sign arbitrary pointers with arbitrary keys and modifiers to bypass pointer authentication. PAC, for those who aren't super familiar with it, it's sort of similar to MTE, though slightly different. It uses the ignored bits in the pointer to store a pointer code, and using special instructions, you get a pointer signed and you verify it. And this makes it so that an attacker won't be able to forge pointers without the ability to sign them. They can't craft pointers to arbitrary data, which limits your corruption capabilities fairly substantially. It hits you both on things like ROP and data-only attacks. So this exploit, the way they bypass PAC is they first get a signed pointer of DLSIM, so for resolving symbols and a dynamic linker. They use that to get a signed pointer to mprotect. Then they build this Mako. They basically build a fake Mako object file. They build a fake Mako header, which has an export that points to the dynamic loader's signed pointer function, build a fake object for the fake Mako header. And then once that fake Mako is injected into the loaded images list, you can just use DLSIM to resolve a signed pointer to signed pointer to be able to call signed pointer with attacker-controlled arguments. So it's basically taking advantage of the dynamic loader in order to get a signed pointer to a pointer signing gadget. So I thought that was a really cool technique. I'm a little bit curious how they fixed that. I'm guessing they either hardened the dynamic loader against being able to load fake objects so easily, or maybe they don't allow signed pointer to be exported anymore in this way. I don't think they've really talked about it in the presentation, but it's a super cool technique, no doubt.
Yeah, so part of the thing for me with this presentation, why I'm a bit unclear, is also, like, how are they building the fake Mako header? Like, do they have, I guess they do have the other corruption that they'd probably be using to kind of craft that.
So there's, like, that, and I believe they also mentioned taking advantage of NS expressions, that Project Zero post that wrote up about it.
I forgot about that stage here. Yeah, because they went from the other vulnerability, and the next step was, I'm trying to find their overview slide again, but don't see where it is here. Yeah, I forgot about the, I guess you also kind of just glossed over that section about the NS expressions. I mean, they don't go too much into it, just the fact that, like, they have their true type.
They just talk about that they leverage it,
use basically. NS expressions. And yeah, because NS expressions kind of, like, almost like a dynamic way of writing a random or arbitrary Objective C code. Like you can translate most Objective C into the NS expressions that can be then used at like runtime.
And notably, it's not really subject to pack. So they can use that to implement their pack bypass and get a nicer code execution going, which I believe is what they do here. What they do with that corruption is they basically get JavaScript going with no JIT and enable the $VM debugging functionality of JS Core to give themselves a read-write primitive inside of a JavaScript, which they then use that JavaScript to implement a kernel exploit. Since there's no JIT, they leverage JS callback objects and ROP gadgets for code exec, which they call out as a popular technique that we used in the PS4 and PS Vita. That was a cool shout out in the presentation. And that brings us to the third bug, which was a kernel bug. And it's incredibly simple as far as Apple phones go. It's wild that this bug is a thing. It really shocked me, as it's an integer overflow in this Mac make memory entry syscall for creating memory entries that can later be mapped. And it takes an input offset and input size. And for bounds checking, it straight up just adds the size to the offset to the parent data offset and checks that against the parent data size. So by simply passing a large size like FFFF, etc., C000, and a size of hex 8000, it'll create a VM entry with a size of FFF repeating C000. So it's pretty insane. That then allows them to use this handle to map physical memory outside of the parent's memory object. They use this in conjunction with the purple graphics mem, which is basically just the graphics frame buffer. And I'm a little unclear on how they leverage it here, but I believe what they do is they map the frame buffer into user space, which then allows them to further map arbitrary physical memory into user space, which can include kernel pages such as memory mapped IO regions, the kernel itself, etc. So what they do there is they use memory mapped IO registers to end up getting the kernel image base address, and they leverage the CPU state and active threads, and using that they can obtain an arbitrary read. The fourth issue was the most insane in the chain, and is actually like a hardware vuln or backdoor, whatever you want to call it. And this comes into play for bypassing kernel mitigation, such as PPL or page protection layer and kernel text read-only region. So talking about these mitigations a bit, since we don't talk about Apple stuff too often, or at least not at this level. PPL is designed to protect signed user space code from being modified post-load, even from like a compromised kernel. The way I understand it is it's basically a hypervisor that protects signed userland code, assigned userland code's page table entries, as well as the pages themselves, and only PPL can modify those page table entries or pages. And kernel text read-only region is a hardware feature where you can use these registers in MMIO to specify a read-only range and lock it so that it's impossible for that range to be edited after those KTRR regions are locked. So it's like a strong write protection for the kernel. So the issue here is in A12 to A16 Bionic chips, there's some registers in the MMIO space. They later found out these were GPU registers, where you can literally write a destination address in one register, write the data through another, and then write the hash of the data. I'm doing hash in air quotes. And that basically gives you an arbitrary write from hardware that is not bound by any of the main CPU memory protections. And these MMIO registers are completely undocumented and unused. As far as they could tell, they're not used by various firmware. It's not used by the kernel itself, coprocessors, anything. After the presentation, Hector Marcan, some of you may know him from Fail Overflow, he speculated on Mastodon about these registers, and he speculated that they called a ha what they call the hash was in fact an ECC code or error correction code. And these registers, he suspects, are cache RAM debug registers for writing to the raw cache memory array. But yeah, I mean, leveraging this feature or vulnerability, they can then patch over page table entries, they can patch PPL protected data, patch the kernel text segment itself. So it's quite an insanely powerful capability, and they can access it from user space due to being able to map the physical pages. What's also insane about it is how it was discovered, because not only do you need to know these registers exist and how to write to them, but the ECC code algorithm also makes it so you need to know how to write the hash or code. Though Marcan stated that the algorithm here is the same as the one that was used on the Wii for ECC, so it might be a somewhat common algorithm for error correction. But still, it seems likely that there was either some insider knowledge that was leaked, either through Apple or through like Apple directly, or through one of their firmware blobs or something that was analyzed, or it was an extremely skilled and knowledgeable researcher's guess based on the GPU area being there and how cache debug registers would be structured. Something that I think shouldn't be discounted either that I haven't really seen talked about, given the fact that there was likely a nation state involved here, given all the complexity and targeting and things like that. It is possible, I think, that there was like hardware digital logic reversing, like potentially decapping Apple chips and discovering the registers and how they're being used that way. I think it's probably unlikely compared to the other speculations of how these registers were discovered, but I think it is a possibility. But yeah,
this was kind of say like that does feel a little bit unlikely just for
it's
this
a bit of a stretch.
Sort of issue being. I don't know. Yeah, it does feel like a bit of a stretch. Like I could see that for some issues. This one doesn't quite feel that way to me. But it is interesting, like, think about how they will figure this out. I didn't realize this was the same algorithm being used over for error correction on the Wii, so that actually... Oh, is the Wii, like, I'm assuming Wii would be ARM then also, yeah? Or, like, is there some overlap going on? Because it seems a little bit weird that, like, information could have been gleaned from the Wii, but at the same time, that could be a source. I don't know, it's definitely interesting. I have no real insight into how it could have been disclosed, but it is kind of interesting to speculate there a bit.
Yeah, just taking a quick look, but I don't think the Wii used...
I think it's PowerPC.
That would line up, yeah. So I think the Wii did have an ARM coprocessor, but I think the main processor was PPC. But...
Although I guess since it's error correction, like I guess it could be... there's memory error correction. Like, I guess it doesn't have to be the same.
I think the architecture is less important there compared to just how the memory controller works, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe that's just irrelevant. I didn't realize that somebody had speculated about the error correction. That was news to me. Otherwise, maybe we'll have tried to look into that a little bit more. Because when I'm seeing this, I see them talking about this as a hash, and they call this the blob over here, like the S-box and stuff. Which is, you know, your standard kind of hashing your crypto lingo for it. It then feels very much like a hash, but I guess an error correction code, you can kind of like check some hash, kind of toss it in that area. Yeah, I don't know.
And the thing with this being like cache debug registers is you can kind of rationalize why that would be a thing. Like perhaps it was just a debugging functionality that wasn't thought about and made it to the main SoCs and was just forgotten about, or they just didn't blacklist it properly, which is how they eventually mitigated this. They just blacklisted the register range from the physical mapping. There's not many other things you could think of it reasonably being other than like a cache memory debugging functionality or something like that. Like it makes sense when you think of it in that frame.
Yeah, I mean the discovery aspect of it's just like it would take some very deep knowledge to have found it. Like they do kind of talk about how this is in that same area as some of the other graphics or GPU stuff, where it's kind of interspersed in there, making it seem like, you know, somebody who's kind of familiar on that side could have kind of uncovered this and found their way to it.
But I'll put it this way, like, you cannot accidentally stumble onto this or even really fuzz for it. It's too structured and it's too... you don't have enough feedback to really...
yeah,
know how to write to it without having a knowledge of the system directly.
Needing the hash really limits how you could discover this, because you need to have that precondition met. Like, you don't accidentally stumble onto it, like you said. But yeah, this is, I think, one of the things that really stood out to me when I was first going through it, is unknown aspect about this. And of course, I saw, you know, some speculation that was planted. It was an intentional backdoor, which I wouldn't really want to make that claim. Since we are, again, talking about nation states, like, it's possible you wouldn't have needed, like, some big group in on a big secret about something like this, especially if it seems like a debug feature. But,
there's not really any evidence that you can point to for that. Like,
yeah, there isn't.
It's hard to make a claim like that.
Yeah, like, I wouldn't put a lot of weight on it.
Talk about backdoors, so.
I just saw plenty of discussion kind of speculating that it could have been an intentional backdoor, which believable at the level, but I think we've got other explanations that fit a bit better, even though we don't have much yet. I mean, who knows? Maybe we will have evidence to the contrary in the future as somebody figures out like exactly what all of it is, but yeah.
So, one thing that I thought was really fun too with this MMIO register attack is it's perfect for hitting Apple devices. In many other cases, you wouldn't need to go this far, like in Linux or even like hardened targets like Android. Generally, once you get kernel read-write or like physical memory access like this, you can do whatever you want to do. It's mostly Apple that's doing all of this post-exploitation mitigation craziness that they're doing with things like PPL and KTRR. So outside of like consoles or iPhone, it's not really a bug class that people are looking for in many other targets. But it is like MemoryMapped.io is a huge attack surface. There's a lot of different devices on the SoC and outside of the SoC that have to be talked to. There's a lot of registers. A lot of it is undocumented. A lot of the firmware is written terribly. So it's a good target to look at, but it's not really been talked about too much because most people don't need to go that far.
Yeah,
So
I
it's
think
cool to see that
Windows
here.
is actually another place where there is a little bit of a push going towards it. Not quite the same, but they are trying to add on the extra layer there with the hypervisor-based security. So in that sense of just popping the kernel not being enough, I think Windows could also make a claim, at least the enterprise and professional. I'm not sure if you've got the hypervisor security on home at all yet.
You do, I just don't think you have direct Hyper-V access, but I think you still get virtualization-based security, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I don't recall for sure. Either way, I mean, Windows is kind of going in that, but I do feel like, the leading edge of that is more Mac OS, in my opinion.
Yeah, Apple is leading the charge on that and has been for a while. So with that exploit chain, they basically have like God mode access, they can patch memory, they can spawn processes, they can do all this crazy stuff. But getting into the attack chain and like the spyware part of it, they actually use another vulnerability as well. They do all of this work. So they use the iMessage vulnerability, the pack bypass, the kernel bug, and the MMIO bug in order to just basically launch Safari to go to an arbitrary page where they have a WebKit exploit set up to exploit the same kernel exploit and get that access again. It's a very over-engineered exploit chain. So they use Safari before they actually use the Safari exploit. They call back to the validator, which will validate the victim with a fingerprint, and then it will launch the Safari exploit stage, leverage that kernel exploit implementation, validate again, and then only then will it run the malware payload. All of this complexity and craziness very much indicates a nation state actor with all the validation and stealth and targeting. The validator would also handle cleanup, like it would delete crash logs, fingerprint with IMEI, user ID, device info, and they would also clean traces of iMessage from specific Apple IDs using MD5 hashes. This part was kind of funny in the presentation because Kaspersky had actually cracked the MD5 hashes to get the emails. So that ended up helping them out for doing analysis and being able to make sure they pull the right artifacts for iMessage from those people. But that was quite a funny part of the presentation.
See, and that is where you drop in at least a few iMessage accounts that aren't related, but that you want like banned or looked at and ruin another campaign, do something like that. But yeah, I
It
mean
could
that
totally be
validator,
possible, yep.
the validator stage there kind of surprised me with the degree to which they look, because that wasn't just like looking at. So they did do like browser fingerprinting. I thought it was interesting. They did actually do like a canvas fingerprint where they would draw a triangle and then look at the actual drawing itself on the canvas, and subtle differences can tell you or can fingerprint the device that way. But they also pulled information like the battery capacity, device information or device name, advertisement ID, and obviously the phone number and stuff in there. Like they pulled a lot of information in order to validate that this is the correct target before they actually went on to launch the Safari tar or the Safari exploit.
Which
Like,
again screams government, like.
yeah, like pulling a lot of information, you would have to then have a fair bit of that information in the first place in order to just drop the exploit, it would seem.
Yeah. So, yeah, they had all this validation. They wanted to be absolutely sure before hitting the victim. But once they did, the malware itself was pretty like powerful in the capabilities that it had. It allowed collection of geolocation data, files, keys from the iOS keychain, data from messengers like WhatsApp, Telegram, iMessage, camera and mic access, info on nearby Apple devices.
The mic access, that stood out to me also because they talked about, maybe you were actually going to get into this. Sorry if I am jumping ahead on you.
I was about to, but yeah, no worries.
But like the mic access and like the fact that they would try and detect if logs are being read. So if logs are being read, it's just going to stop and it's going to report back that, like, you know, hey, we might have been caught, or wouldn't do any recording if the phone was actually on, so there was no visual way of detecting it. Just some of that I thought was kind of interesting, the degree of stealth they went to. Like, it makes sense that they would do so while trying to record something and then kind of record that metadata in the middle of it to see what's actually going on and try and detect any sort of problem there.
I think was the more interesting part of it, was that they had this custom recording format that would run when the screen was off. It would record audio and events around when that audio was happening to try to, like, build a picture of, like, basically create snapshots of points of time when it would be recording. I thought that was pretty interesting. So it's not only stealthy, but it's trying to get a lot of information while it's doing it, like, it beyond just the audio.
Yeah, and they mentioned kind of setting some traps. As I was talking about, somebody tries to look at the logs or something, it would then go and inform the attackers and stuff. Just a lot of thought being put into this aspect of it. And I don't know, I can't compare to what anybody else is doing, because it feels like we don't get a lot of this information too often.
This is rare, yeah, to be able to get this much info. Like, we cover the threat analysis groups, Google's tags posts, somewhat often, but they don't tend to get nearly as much information on the campaign as was gotten here. This is a lot of fascinating information. Like, I think this is probably the most we've seen on, like, a nation state chain since, like, in, I want to say, like, 5 to 10 years, probably. Yeah, I can't remember anything recently that had this much detail to it.
Yeah, at least that, you know, we're reading. In fairness, people who probably do threat intel maybe just see that
more often. Sorry, to the public. Yeah.
I don't even know if I'd want to make the claim to the public, because there's a fair chance that somebody who's in threat intel who's looking at this information a lot probably has a better understanding over what some, like, that level malware is doing, that as somebody that just comes across it in passing, like, it took something like this to actually make it to me.
I kind of wish we had Anti around for this topic specifically. But
maybe alas, we could reach out and do another episode with him.
Maybe, yeah. This topic would definitely warrant it. It's a very interesting chain. But yeah, so it has all this capability. It's a very complex attack chain. I find it interesting that they were targeting, like, it seemed to be targeting Kaspersky researchers. I'm wondering about the question, like, why? Like, I don't know if it'd be, like, for stealing other vulnerabilities or exploits, or if it's related to the suspected things with Kaspersky and, like, the government or whatever, I don't know. But it struck me as a very interesting target to go after, like, targeting researchers with this complex of a chain. Now, to be fair, I think the reason that this chain is so complex is because it's targeting researchers. So a little bit before the episode, Z and I were talking, and Z was asking, like, why would they go through all this effort? Like, especially with doing the second half of the chain, where it's like they're exploiting all these ODAs just to identify the victim before launching the WebKit exploit and then hitting the kernel exploit again. It seems like a lot of work and a lot of redundancy. And I think the reason for that is because where they're attacking researchers here, they really wanted to make sure before doing anything that is easily traceable, like installing backdoor processes or editing the kernel or anything, they really wanted to make sure that their environment was suitable, because they mentioned the validator checks for things like Relium and such. Like, it's obvious they wanted to avoid introspection as much as possible. And if there would be anyone that would be introspecting the kernel state or the state of the device, it would be, like, Kaspersky's researchers, right? So it kind of makes sense from that point of view that they would go through all this effort and not leave any, like, backdoor installs with their first chain until they made sure that Corellium wasn't, like, they weren't running inside of Corellium or there was no debugging introspecting going on or anything. It kind of makes sense when you consider that context.
It makes sense to do that validation. it still seems weird to go through the iMessage attack to the kernel exploit. You get all the validation, and sure, do the validation before actually dropping the malware or whatever. But to then go through another exploit, the Safari exploit, that kind of felt excessive. Although, kind of before we recorded this, you kind of remind me that the iMessage is going to be like oh is likely going to be a one shot thing, where so there wouldn't have been like a good communication channel or way of kind of sharing that information back. That could be why they had to kind of push over onto running the Safari exploit and kind of dropping another O-day in the chain. So like there are reasons for it, but it's definitely surprising to see so many, because usually you kind of think of the exploit, or at least I usually think of the exploit chains as having that user land, going from user, maybe sandbox escape from there, and having the kernel and kind of going from that, and not
It's
a
very rare
user
you exploit
kernel,
user
user
land
kernel.
again after hitting the kernel.
Yeah. Like it could be because they're targeting the researchers. Although with that, like it does feel like their cleaning was a bit lazy, as they kind of called out, leaving the folders. Although maybe they didn't really care about the indicators of compromise and just the actual compromising data. Like they didn't want the iMessage exploit to be left behind, but they didn't really care if there were indicators that they had been compromised, e.g., the folders left over.
I think it was just a mistake. I think they wanted to hide indicator of compromise as well.
I would imagine
There's
so,
multiple points in the
but
presentation where they like the things they call out that they're doing are just to prevent even like the thing where they would not record if the screen was on and things like that, and leave like a potential OPSEC compromise message upon inspecting the event logs. Like things like that made me think that it was just somehow missed amongst the complexity of this chain, right? Like, it's easy to point at it in hindsight and be like, oh, haha, they forgot about these artifacts. They left these MD5 things that we could crack. But it's like when you have so much complexity and so many steps in the chain, it's so easy to make mistakes at one given point, right?
MD5, actually, I didn't think about this before. That's an interesting
That was an odd
choice
choice.
because they would have had access to other hashes. Like, it's not like they were restricted to only using MD5.
You would think they would use something that would be a lot harder to crack.
Well, so then it kind of comes down to, well, how old is this code? Because they do talk about the APT platform that gets dropped for the malware. Does seem to be over a decade old. Like it is able to run on very old devices. And so they speculate that. They also, for what it's worth, we're talking about this in iOS context. They also have reason to believe that the validator and stuff would have been called on Mac OS at the same time. Or not at literally at the same time, but would have been used with Mac OS also. And so wasn't only targeting the iPhones, or wasn't only used in that context. But yeah, so the platform itself that gets dropped, could be a decade plus old. So like, is that code that old such that MD5 would have been like a common hash choice for that? Because I mean, so MD5 still gets used today in like, obviously you should never use MD5 for password hashing. We're beyond that these years, I hope. But MD5 still gets used for like integrity checking, for passing the data along, and like making sure data wasn't corrupted. Like it still kind of has that checksum use, and that's fair. Today, I feel like, a modern choice would have been to use like the SHA family. It's still a quick hash, but offers a bit more resistance. So either they may have wanted those IDs to be broken, kind of going back with my speculation about including some IDs that are necessarily part of the campaign and kind of having that intentionality going on. Or, is it possible that this is actually like an old, very old delivery method that they've been doing for so long that it's just like it was MD5 back then, 15 years ago? Wouldn't be that surprising that somebody just chose MD5.
To be fair, I'm not sure how different using, like, let's say SHA-256 or SHA-512. I'm not sure how different that would really be, because in the context of cracking like these email lists, your key space is pretty small, right? Like you're always gonna have the at and then probably some common mail provider at the end. You're gonna have like maybe 10 characters. It's gonna be alphanumeric. Not a lot of special characters allowed. So even if you had like SHA or something, it probably some of them still probably could have been cracked anyway. Maybe not as many or maybe not as quickly, but the hashing algorithm might not be super relevant just given the strings that you would be cracking being fairly guessable, or at least most of it being fairly guessable. But I'm not a huge crypto person or anything, so I don't want to speak on that super confidently. I'm not sure the cracking speed of like SHA-256 versus
You
MD5. I
are
don't know if you
right.
do.
Like MD5 is faster than SHA, but like the SHA family is still a fast algorithm. But I think the question is, why hash it at all if they're not concerned about it being broken? Either like they want to have the appearance of the concern that they don't want to be broken, but then they use the weak hash knowing that's going to be broken anyhow, or dated. Like I don't see a good explanation for it. Like, yeah, if they use SHA, it still have been. Still likely could have been broken. That is a fair point. That maybe that wouldn't have been a good option if they actually wanted to keep these hidden, but why hash it in the first place if they're not concerned about that? If it's just kind of accidental or they wouldn't have wanted that security. I'm sure somebody's just going to, put in a comment and tell us like, yeah, perfectly reasonable reason to go for it, like, whatever, but because
It's things like this are like my favorite thing with these campaigns, because it's questions you have where you're trying to rationalize it, and you might be right, but like you said, it could be like a misdirection thing. When it comes to like nation states especially, there's gaslighting that goes on where you try to like hide your hand and try to leave evidence that it was someone else and not you and things like that. Like it makes it very fun trying to analyze it. Though that's definitely not like our area of expertise. That's a little bit more into Ante's area, but and like threat analysis in general, threat intel stuff. But it
yeah.
is fun to speculate on still. And yeah, like the choice of MD5, it is interesting. It's hard to say much more than that. It's hard to rationalize why they would have chose it. It personally, I feel like your speculation on it just being because it was old code and reused code. That makes the most sense to me. It's kind of like the simplest explanation is likely correct. I think it's just that it was older code. MD5 wasn't blinked at as much back then as it is now, and that's why it was able to be cracked as easily as it was.
Yeah, like, I mean, we're probably never going to know. I'd be interested to
We
know
will
if
never know.
somebody's got like a really just
Like
reasonable
a different,
explanation on it, but it stood
different take
out to
on it.
me,
Yeah.
MD5 being used. Just, it stands out, and like you said, it's interesting.
And just like I said, attacking like security researchers like this is interesting because it makes me question the end goal. Like, is it worth burn like potentially burning like 5 O-days like this and all this effort just to like steal exploits? Probably not, I would think. So the motivation is also like an interesting thing here. It's hard to guess. I'm not really a geopolitical thing, so
Yeah, I don't know
maybe there's
what
some
all.
reasons that I wouldn't think of, but.
I don't know what all like Kaspersky's research team would do. Because yeah, we're obviously thinking about vulnerability research, but of course Kaspersky is doing like the, malware and all of that too. Like their researchers may not just be limited to just vulnerability research. There could be other things going on.
Other things of value, yeah.
Yeah, could be part of the whole cat and mouse. Like, are they close to detecting some other campaign? Like, having that backdoor into Kaspersky. Like, I'm sure Kaspersky has some good information that they would want, and researchers having have highly privileged access or something.
Yeah. But all that aside, like that's just fun speculation. The vulnerabilities that were abused here were pretty crazy, especially like the kernel bug and the MMIO bug. Those were just pretty wild. The TrueType 1 isn't super surprising. Font, like whenever you're talking about font processing and text processing, it's one of those older areas of code that people don't want to touch, and that's exemplified here. The fact that this adjust functionality was there since the early 90s, it's just not something most people want to look at or redo or anything. They just don't want to touch it. So it's not surprising there was a vulnerability there and they were able to exploit it fairly easily. The pack bypass had some cool factors to it with abusing legitimate functionality in that way. But yeah, the MMIO bug was definitely like the cherry on the cake for me, and that's what I saw getting shared around the most because it does have that juicy backdoor-esque kind of aspect to it. So,
I'm sure
quite a
whoever
crazy
found
chain.
that is disappointed that it's been burned.
Yeah,
I'm sure
that
whoever
would be a
was
very nice
using this
primitive.
is disappointed it's been burned.
Yeah, this whole chain being burned is probably not a good day for whoever was running the campaign, but it's fun for us. You know, we get some information that, like I said, is pretty rare. You don't really get this level of depth of analysis on exploit campaigns and this much
At
insight.
this
So,
level, yeah, at
yeah.
like this apparent level.
So even though we talked through it here, I would recommend pretty much everyone who listens to us to check out this talk, even if you're not super into iOS or even like that level of memory corruption. There's just something in it for everybody, I think. It's a very fascinating story, and for that reason, I would recommend this talk to pretty much everybody.
Yeah, this
So.
is a good talk. A very dense talk. Like so many times during him, like in so many other talks, it'd be like, they'd be done at this point. Like this would be the end. And it's like, oh, I'm
They packed
15
a
minutes
lot into
in.
58 minutes. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so that's all the topics that we have for today. Thanks goes out to all of you for listening. If you want to go back and check out past episodes, you can find them on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more links on Anchor. Feel free to join Discord and follow us on Twitter. Links for those are down below in the description, or you can find them on our website, azrsec.com. And yeah, we will see you next week.